Stanley Lombardo has a BA from Loyola University in New Orleans, MA from Tulane, and a PhD from the University of Texas. He has done many, many translations, including Homer's Iliad, which received the Byron Calderon Book Award. One of my favorite anecdotes I mined on the net was that as he translated the Iliad, he had a coin with the head of Homer on the front, and when he finished that and moved to the Odyssey, he flipped the coin over, which had a picture of a ship. So that is one of his inspirations. He also told an interviewer that he would never translate Ovid. It was too playful. And never say never. Our Stan, who is a wonderful human being and translator and professor and has been head of the honors program, has a serious inspiration in the practicing of Zen. He will read to us from Ovid's Metamorphosis, which came out last fall.
Thank you. It's true that I never thought I would translate Ovid. I've always said I only translate the poets I fell in love with deeply when I was an undergraduate. And so when I was asked, I was at Hollins College in Virginia, Women's College, 2 years ago, doing a reading, and a young woman asked, well, when are you going to translate Ovid's Metamorphoses? I said, well, never. She said, why? And see, I'd known Ovid as a virtuoso poet, very facile, can do anything in verse. And I explained that. I said, but he has no soul. And she, at that point, stood up. Ovid does, too, have a soul. It's a skanky soul. But it's a soul. And I thought to myself, well, I'm not sure what skanky means. And at dinner, we were wondering, is this still a common parlance, skanky? Yeah. Yeah. It's replaced raunchy. It's what?
Skanky.
Well,
Skanky Possum.
Yeah, I know the magazine, the Skanky Possum from Austin. Yeah, I know that literary magazine. But at any rate, I thought, well, I probably have a skanky soul too, and my publisher wants a translation of Ovid's Metamorphoses, and I'm supposed to be doing Dante's Purgatorio for my sabbatical. But hey, I'll give it a try, and I started in. And I completely fell in love with this poet, whom I had, you know, read mostly, in Latin, a few of the favorites, and some of the favorites, the old chestnuts, I'll read to you in a moment. And it taught, mythology, where you kind of just use the stories to teach the myth, you know. But when I really got into the poetry itself, as you can only do when you're translating it and trying to merge your voice with the voice of the original, I became aware of just all sorts of subtleties and depth that I just had not encountered before. And so once I got into it, I saw that I didn't want to do anything else, and I was on sabbatical. So I set myself the project of doing the entire Metamorphoses, and you can pronounce it Metamorphoses also and be perfectly correct, in 100 days, and that's what I did. At some point, I'll read you the poem that inspired the cover of this. I think that'll be the last thing that I read. It's almost impossible to decide what to read. There are over 220 stories in verse in the Metamorphoses. It's cast as a continuous epic from the creation of the world up to the poet's own times. Kind of ends with the deification of Julius Caesar, which happened maybe 25 years before he began to write the poem. And the stories are all linked together in very clever ways, but when it comes down to it, what you have is a whole lot of short stories in verse, some very brief, some longer. I'm going to read six of them, which are maybe in some way representative. I've chosen six, but if anybody wants one, say now. Then I'll read the six that I chose, for better or for worse. I have the feeling that there are a lot of members of the Professional Society of English Majors here tonight. So I'm going to start with one that's a story that's familiar from Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. This is the original, folks, of the Pyramus and Thisbe story. Oh, metamorphoses, of course, means stories about transformations, and Ovid has some sort of transformation in each of these stories, which range very widely indeed. Pyramus and Thisbe. Pyramus and Thisbe. He, the loveliest of boys, she the most beautiful girl in the Orient, lived next door to each other in the steep city, they say, Semiramis, encircled with walls of brick. Proximity led to their early acquaintance. Love grew with time, and they would have married, but their parents forbade it. What they could not forbid was the mutual passion they felt for each other. There was no go-between. Their talk was nods and gestures, and the more the fire was covered, the hotter it burned. There was a slender chink in the common wall between the two houses from when they were built. No one had noticed this crack in all these years, but what does love not see? You lovers discovered it and made a channel for speech. Your loving words would slip safely through it in the softest whispers. Often, when they had moved into place, Thisbe here, Pyramus there, and each had felt the other's breath, they would say, "Jealous wall, why do you stand between lovers? Would it be asking too much for you to allow us to embrace, or at least open enough to allow us to kiss? Not that we are ungrateful. We owe it to you, we admit, that our words have passage to the ears that long to hear them." So they would talk in frustrated separation. And when night came on, they said, "Goodbye," each pressing their lips on one side of the wall, kisses that did not go through to the other side. The next dawn had banished the stars of night, the sun's rays had dried the frosty grass, and the lovers came to their accustomed place. After many whispered complaints, the pair decided that they would try to slip past their guardians in the still of night, and when they were outdoors, they would leave the city as well. And they agreed, so as not to be wandering around in the fields, to meet at Ninus's tomb and hide under its tree. The tree there was full of snow-white berries, a tall mulberry tree next to a cool spring. They liked the plan. The light seemed to last forever, then sank into the waters from which night arose. Stealthily cracking open the door, Thisbe sneaks out through the shadows with veiled head, comes to the tomb, and sits beneath the appointed tree. Love made her bold. But now, here comes a lioness, her jaws smeared with the blood of cattle she's just killed, on her way to slake her thirst at the spring. Babylonian Thisbe sees her far off by the light of the moon, and runs on trembling feet into a dark cave. And as she runs, her cloak slips off her back. When the savage lioness has drunk her fill, she turns back to the woods and happens upon the cloak without the girl in it, and shreds it in her bloody jaws. Coming out a little later, Pyramus sees the tracks the lioness left in the deep dust. The collar drains from his face, and when he finds the cloak too, smeared with blood, "One night," he cries, "will be the death of two lovers, but of the two she was more deserving of life, and mine has done all the harm. I have destroyed you, poor girl, telling you to come by night to this place full of terror and not coming first myself. Come and tear my body apart, devour my flesh, gulp down my guilty heart with your savage jaws. Oh, all of you lions who have lairs in this cliff." But it is cowardly just to pray for death. He picked up Thisbe's cloak and carried it to the shade of the trysting tree. And while he kissed and shed tears upon the garment he knew so well, he cried, "Drink my blood too, Drawing the sword that hung by his waist, he drove it deep into his flank, then, dying, withdrew it from the hot wound. As he lay stretched out on the earth, his blood spurted high, just as when a lead pipe has sprung a leak at a weak spot, and through the hissing fissure, long jets of water shoot forth into the air. The fruit on the tree, sprinkled with Pyramus blood, turned dark, and the tree's roots, soaked with his gore, dyed the mulberries the same purple color. And now Thisbe, still afraid but anxious too that her lover will miss her, comes back from the cave, seeking Pyramus with her eyes and her soul, and excited to tell him about her brush with death. She recognizes the place and the shape of the tree, but the color of the fruit makes her wonder if this is really it. While she hesitates, she sees a body writhing on the blood-soaked ground. She stepped back, her face paler than boxwood, shivering like the sea when a light breeze grazes its surface. But when, a moment later, she recognized her lover, she slapped her guiltless arms in loud lamentation and tore her hair out, and holding his beloved body, she filled his wounds with her tears, mingling them with his blood. And as she kissed his cold lips, she wailed, "Pyramus, what happened? What took you from me? Answer me, Pyramus. It's your dearest Thisbe calling you. Please listen. Please lift up your head." At Thisbe's name, Pyramus lifted his eyes, heavy with death, saw her, and closed them again. Then she noticed her cloak, and saw his ivory scabbard without his sword in it, and said, "Your own hand and your love killed you, poor boy. I too have a hand, brave for this one deed. I too have love, and it will give me the strength to face wounds. I will follow you in death, and I will be called the most wretched cause and companion of your death. Death alone could tear you from me, but not even death will. And I pray to my wretched parents and to his, on behalf of both of us, do not begrudge a common tomb to those whom faithful love and death's final hour have joined. And you, O tree, whose branches now cover one pitiful body and soon will cover two, keep our death's tokens and always have fruit that is dark and mournful as a memorial to the blood that we both shed." She spoke, and placing the point beneath her breast, she fell onto the blade, still warm with her lover's blood. Her prayers touched the gods and touched their parents, for mulberries turn dark red when they ripen, and the lover's ashes rest in a single urn. Isn't that sweet? You know? Av is really good on girls in general. And there's a girl in this next piece. Her name is Salmacus. She's not well known, but the guy that she was hot for, Hermaphroditus, has at least a famous name. It gives us the word hermaphrodite. As the story tells us, he is a son of Hermes and Aphrodite. He's still just a boy. But etymology is destiny. Learn now why the infamous spring of Salmacus enervates men who bathe in its waters. The cause is hidden, but the font's power well known. Mercury and Venus, that's Hermes and Aphrodite, had a little boy whom naiads nursed in the caves of Ida. You could tell from his face who his parents were, and he was named after both his mother and father. When he turned 15, he left his native mountains and nourishing Ida. Exploring new places and seeing unknown rivers was all his joy, his enthusiasm making light of the toil. He even reached Lycia and neighboring Caria, and there he saw a pool of crystal water, clear to the bottom. There were no marsh reeds, barren sedge, or rushes, only translucent water edged with fresh turf and grass verdant year-round. Whenever you see a place like this in Ovid, you know there's something really bad going to happen. A nymph lived in that pool. A nymph not inclined to hunt or shoot arrows or go racing along, the only naiad unknown to Diana, who's the goddess of chastity. Her sisters were always saying to her, Symmachus, pick up a javelin or a painted quiver and vary your leisure with a little hard hunting. But she did not pick up a javelin or painted quiver or vary her leisure with any hard hunting. She only bathes her beautiful limbs in a pool, often arranges her hair with a boxwood comb, looking into the water to see what becomes her, wraps her body in a transparent robe and reclines in the leaves or on the soft grass. She also picked flowers and was picking flowers when she saw the boy and wanted to have what she saw. But eager as she was, she didn't go up to him until she composed herself, looked at her rose from all angles, touched up her face, and did everything she could to look beautiful, and then she said, boy? Or God? If you are a god, you must be Cupid. But if you are a mortal, blessed be your parents, your brother, your sister, if you have one, and the woman who nursed you. But happier than any of these is your bride-to-be. If there's any girl you think worthy, if there is one, let me steal my pleasure. If there is no one yet, let me be the one, and let's get married right now. The naiad fell silent. A blush crossed the boy's cheeks, for he knew nothing of love. But it was a becoming blush, the color of apples ripening in a sunny orchard, or dyed ivory, or the moon's scarlet glow when bronze cymbals clash to end an eclipse. When the nymph kept begging for a sister's kiss, at least, and was twining her arms around his ivory neck, he cried out, just stop, or I'll leave this spot and leave you with it. So Symmachus trembled and said, it's all yours, and turning away, pretended to leave. But she kept looking back and hid in a thicket, crouching on one knee. He, as a boy will, who thinks he's alone, explored the green bank and dipped first his toes in the ripples and then his feet up to the ankles, finding the water enticing and just the right temperature. He slipped the clothes from his supple body. The nymph was spellbound, burning with passion. And her eyes now were as bright as sunlight reflected in a mirror. She could barely endure any more delay, any further deferral of joy, and was out of her mind with the desire to hold him. The boy, clapping his body with cupped palms, dove in quickly and began swimming the crawl, his body gleaming in the translucent water as if it were an ivory figurine or a lily encased in glass. I've got him now, cried the nymph, as she threw off her clothes and dove into the pool. He tries to hold her off as she steals contested kisses, runs her hands down his body, fondles a reluctant breast, enfolds him on one side and then on the other. Finally, as he struggled to release himself, she twisted around him as if she were a snake snatched up by an eagle up into the sky. Hanging from his claws, the snake slithers around the raptor's head and feet and entangles his wings, or as if she were ivy entwining a tree trunk, or an octopus holding its prey under sea with its tentacles wrapped completely around it. The boy hung in there and denied the nymph the pleasure she hoped for. Yay, hermaphroditus. And yet, she held on tight, as if her whole body were welded onto his. You may fight me, you little rascal, she said. But you'll never escape. Gods, may the day not dawn that will separate him from me or me from him. Her prayer was answered. Their bodies were blended into one face and form. Just as when a twig is grafted onto a tree, you can see two branches mature into one, so too these bodies fused in tenacious embrace. Not two, not double, neither woman nor man, yet somehow both. When he saw that the waters he entered as a male had left him half a man and softened his limbs, Hermaphroditus stretched out his hands and cried in a voice no longer manly, Father and mother, grant to the son who bears both of your names that whoever enters this pool as a man comes out as a half man, weakened by the water. His parents blessed the words of their biform son and drugged the pool to engender confusion. It reminds me of a time when I went out to Lake Lone Star it was administered some kind of, well, I don't know, magic mushrooms, I guess. It was really something out there that day. Well, that's a little skanky, I would say. Daedalus and Icarus is a well-known story. It's Ovid who tells it. No one else does, as far as I know. So here's the classic original. It's very brief. What happens is that Minos is the king of Crete, and his wife Pasiphae fell in love with a bull and wanted to mate with him, and how is this going to work? You know, and so Minos hired the genius of the age, Daedalus, who could contrive any kind of invention, any kind of contraption, and he contrived this kind of a wooden cow in which Pasiphae positioned herself in such a way that she could mate with this bull, and she gave birth to this hybrid monster called the, everyone? Very good. Okay. And then Minos wouldn't let Daedalus leave. This guy is way too cool to ever let him get away. So Daedalus, meanwhile, hating his long exile in Crete and longing for the place of his birth, was locked in by the sea. Crete is an island. He may block land and sea, he said, but the sky is open. We will go that way. Minos may own everything, but he does not own the air. And turning his mind toward unknown arts, he transformed nature. Spreading out feathers, he arranged them in order from shortest to longest, as if climbing a slope, the way reeds once rose into a panpipe's shape, a story that Ovid tells earlier. Then he bound the midline of the quills with thread and the ends with wax, and bent the formation into a slight curve, imitating a real bird's wing. His son Icarus, like you know, he kind of sat there and stood, he's unaware. He's playing with everything. He's touching his peril. The beaming boy would try to catch feathers blown by the breeze, or would knead the yellow wax with his thumb. And as he played, generally got in the way of his genius father at work. And when he had put the finishing touches on his craft, the great artisan suspended himself between two identical wings, and his body hovered in the moving air. Then he equipped his son, saying, Stay in the middle, Icarus, I warn you. If you go lower, the water will weigh down the feathers. Higher, the sun's heat will scorch them. Fly in between. Don't gawk at Boötes, the Dipper, or the Sword of Orion. Pick out your path by following me. He gave him his flying instructions while fitting the unfamiliar wings to his shoulders. And what with the work and the admonitions, his old cheeks grew moist, and his father's hands trembled. He kissed his dear son, a kiss never to be repeated. And rising on wings, he flies ahead in fear for his companion, like a bird who leads its tender young into the air from its aerial nest, urging him to follow, teaching him ruinous arts, and beating his own wings as he looks back at his son. A fisherman with a trembling rod sees them, or a shepherd leaning on his staff, or a plowman. They gape at these beings negotiating the air and take them for gods. Juno's isle, Samos, is now on the left. Delos and Paris are long gone. And on the right are Labynthus and honeyed Calymne. When the boy, you really shouldn't have done this, begins to enjoy this daring flight and veers off from his leader, he is drawn to the sky and goes higher. Proximity to the blazing sun softens the scented wax that bound the feathers, and the wax melts. He beats his naked arms, but lacking plumage cannot purchase air, and his mouth was shouting his father's name when the blue water, which takes its name from his, closed over his body. His bereft father, a father no more, cried, "Icarus, where are you, Icarus? Where should I look for you?" And kept calling, "Icarus." Then he saw the feathers in the water. He swore off his arts and buried the body. And the land is known by the name on the tomb. So that's a sad story, but not as sad as the story of Orpheus and Eurydice. Okay. The god of marriage has just been at the wedding of Iphis and Ianthe, and that's kind of an interesting story because Iphis was born as a girl, but his mother had to conceal that he was a girl because her husband didn't want a girl. You know, and so this girl falls in love with another girl and wishes he were. It's a complicated sex change story, but they eventually get married, and that's where the god of marriage has been. So, trailing his saffron robes through the immense ether, the god of marriage Hymen flew down to the shores of Thrace, heeding the vain summons of Orpheus's voice. He was present, yes, but brought no solemn words, no joyous expressions, no happy omen. Even the torch that he held just hissed with teary smoke, and no matter how much he shook it, would not catch fire. The outcome was worse than the portent. Orpheus's bride, Eurydice, walking through the grass after the wedding with her naiad friends, was bitten in the heel by a snake and died. The Thracian bard had filled the upper air with his laments and then made a bold descent to the Taenarian Styx to try the spirits below. And wading through the insubstantial images of the buried dead, he came before Persephone and the lord of the unlovely realms of shades. Touching the strings of his lyre, he sang, "Rulers of the world beneath the earth, to which all of us mortal creatures recede, if you will permit me to speak the simple truth without a hint of lies, I have not come down here to see lightless Tartarus or to claim the Medusan monster's three viperous throats. I have come for my wife, bitten in the heel by an adder whose poison has stolen her youth. I wanted to be able to bear this, and I did try. Love prevailed, a god known well in the world below. If the story of that old abduction is true, love joined you too as well. By this place full of fear, by immense chaos and the silence of this vast realm, reweave, I beg you, Eurydice's fates. We are all owed to you, and after a brief delay, we all come back to this place. This is our destination, our last home, and you hold the longest reign over the human race. She too, after she has lived a normal span of years, will be yours by right. We are asking for a loan. But if the fates deny pardon for my wife, I will not go back. Delight in the death of two. As he said these things, plus plucking the strings to his words, the bloodless shades wept. Tantalus stopped trying to scoop up the receding water, and Ixion's wheel was stunned. The vultures left off from Titius' liver. Belus's granddaughters put down their leaking urns, and even you, Sisyphus, sat on your stone. Inque tuo sedisti, Sisyphe Saxo. Couldn't help but get in a little Latin there. Then, for the first time, they say, the Furies, charmed by his song, wet their cheeks, nor could the royal consort or her dark lord refuse his request. They called Eurydice, who was still among the recent shades, walking slowly with a limp from her wound. Orpheus received her with this condition. He must not look back until he had left the Valley of Avernus, or the gift would be void. The path wound up through deafening silence along a steep, dark slope shrouded in fog. They were approaching the upper rim when the lover, fearing for his partner and eager to see her, turned his eyes. She fell back at once, stretching out her arms, trying to catch and be caught, and sorry to take hold of nothing but air. Dying again, she did not blame her husband. What could she complain of except that she was loved? She said her last goodbye, which he could barely hear, and whirled back again to where she had been. The story goes on, but I think that's the natural stopping point. Orpheus decides to renounce women completely, and he actually introduces homoerotic love to Thrace. And then, this is in Book 10 of the Odyssey, and the poet then has Orpheus be the singer of all of the stories in Book 10. And he tells some very weird stories. And among them is the story of Pygmalion. You all know My Fair Lady. Here's the original. Pygmalion had seen these women, and never mind who they are, they're the first prostitutes, according to Ovid, living in shame and offended by the faults that nature had lavished on the female psyche. Lived as a bachelor without any bedmate. Meanwhile, he sculpted with marvelous skill a figure in ivory, giving it a beauty no woman could be born with. And he fell in love what he had made. Now this is a time to pause. Don't we all do that all the time? Especially, you know, what we have most made, which is our precious selves. Well, I can't. This begs for allegorical interpretation. So I just insert that. It had the face of a real girl. A girl you would think who wanted to be aroused, if modesty permitted. To such a degree does art conceal art. Recognize that? This is the original. Okay, so. Pygmalion gazes in admiration, inhaling passion for a facsimile body. We all make it up all the time. He often touches the statue to find out whether it is ivory or flesh, and is unwilling to admit that it is ivory. He kisses it and thinks his kisses are returned. He speaks to it. And when he holds it, he seems to feel his fingers sinking into its limbs, and then fears he might leave bruises where he is pressed. He makes sweet talk to it, brings it gifts, the kind that girls like, shells and smooth pebbles, little birds, colorful flowers, and the Heliades amber tears that drip down from trees. He drapes robes around it, puts jewel rings on its fingers, and long necklaces around its décolletage. When was the last time you heard that word? All these things are beautiful, but the statue is no less beautiful nude. He lays it on a bed, spread with coverlets dyed Tyrian blue, and calls the statue his bedmate, resting its reclining head on downy pillows as if he could feel them. This is like Lars and the Real Girl. And now it was the festal day of Venus, and all of Cyprus turned out to celebrate. Heifers with gilded horns had fallen when the axe came down on their snowy necks, and incense smoked on the altars. Pygmalion offered his sacrifice, and standing at the altar, timidly prayed to the goddess and all the gods. O gods, if you can grant all things, my prayer is that I may have as a wife, he didn't dare say, my ivory girl, but said instead, someone like my ivory girl. But golden Venus, who of course was present at her own festival, knew what his prayer meant. And as an omen of her divinity's favor, the flame on the altar flared up three times. It's always a good omen. Back home, he went to his simulacrum and, bending over the couch, gave it a kiss. She seemed to be warm. He kissed her again and touched her breast with his hand. The ivory was growing soft to the touch, and as it lost its stiff hardness, it yielded to his fingers, as Hymettian wax softens under the sun and can be kneaded and molded by the thumb into many forms, its use growing through use. The lover is astounded. Cautiously rejoicing and fearing he is mistaken, he tests his hopes again and again with his hand. It's a real body. The veins were throbbing under his thumb. Our Paphian hero poured out thanksgiving to the goddess Venus and pressed his lips onto real lips at last. The girl felt the kisses, blushed, and lifting her shy eyes up to the light, took in the sky and her lover together. The goddess attended the marriage she had made, and when nine moons had filled their crescent horns, a daughter was born to them, Paphos, for whom the island of Paphos is named. I won't read the next story because it's so long, but Paphos's son was Cinyras, and he had a daughter, Mira, who fell in love with her father. The poem takes about 20 minutes to read, so I can't read it, but you can imagine what Ovid would do with this. But I want to conclude with the poem that inspired this cover, which may be hard to see from where you are, but when you buy your copy later, you'll be able to inspect it very closely. This is from a gallery in DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C., owned by Micheline Klagsburn. And the entire show about a year ago was all based on Ovid's Metamorphoses. And, you know, as my publisher was trying to describe this to me before, so he said, well, it looks like the sort of thing that you see on the wall of a lesbian psychotherapist, you know, that kind of art. And, well, there you go, you know. What it is, it's you can kind of see it's a couple embracing and turning into snakes. That's what it is. And the couple's Cadmus and Harmonia. And Harmonia is a daughter of Mars, of Ares. And Cadmus is the founder of Thebes. He was sent on a mission by his father, Agenor, to find his Agenor's daughter, Europa, Cadmus' sister, who had been abducted by Zeus in the form of a bull. And the bull kind of seduced her, kind of, get on my back, baby, and then kind of walked out to sea and started to swim and swam all the way to Crete. And the story goes on there. And Agenor said, you go find your sister. And so he traipses all over the world, and finally he comes to where Thebes is going to be, and this huge dragon confronts him. And this epic battle, Ovid tells the whole story, and the dragon ensues, and he kills the dragon, and then, following the oracle, he takes all the teeth of the dragon and sews them, and they become armed men, and they fight each other, and the survivors become the first citizens of Thebes. That's the founding of Thebes. And his wife is, as I said, Harmonia. The dragon was sent by Mars, and it's a complicated story. They have lots of kids, and it's all a total disaster, as it often is with kids. But these are like real disasters, you know, one after another. I won't even begin to go in with it. But the couple stay together in spite of everything. The latest thing that happened was that his daughter and his little grandson had to jump off a cliff. And he just saw them jump off a cliff, and he didn't know they were turned into sea gods. So that was like a plus that he didn't even know about. But anyway, Agenor's son, Cadmus, did not know that his daughter and little grandson were now sea gods. Overwhelmed by the string of disasters, the suffering he had seen, he now left the city he had founded, as if the place itself and at his own misfortunes were weighing down upon him. His long wandering took him and his wife to Illyria's borders up north, where, sad and old, they thought of their family's original destiny and rehearsed their sorrow. So it's like an old couple who have been through a lot trying to understand their life. What was that all about? If there are any old couples here, maybe you understand what I'm talking about here. Cadmus said, that serpent, that dragon, I pierced with my spear, must have been sacred. There I was, fresh from Sidon, and I scattered its teeth, a strange seed, on the earth. If that is what the gods have been avenging in their terrible anger, may I lay out my length as a long-bellied snake. And as he spoke, he did lay out his length as a long-bellied snake and felt his skin turn into hard black scales checkered with blue. As he lay on his stomach, his legs fused together and tapered to a point. What was left of his arms, he stretched out to his wife, and with tears running down his still human cheeks, come here, he said, my poor, ill-starred wife, while there is still something left of me, come here and touch me. Hold my hand while it is still a hand, while the serpent has not usurped me completely. He wanted to say much more, but suddenly his tongue was forked and words wouldn't come, and even plaintive sounds came out as a hiss, the only voice that his nature allowed him. Then, striking her naked breast with her hands. Harmonia cried out, "My poor Cadmus, wait! Shake this off, this monstrosity! Cadmus, what is it? Where are your feet, your hands, your shoulders, your face, your color? Everything changing as I speak. Change me as well, you gods, into this same serpentine form." She spoke, and his tongue flickered over the face of his wife, and he slid down between the breasts that he loved, and his embrace sought the neck he knew so well. Their companions were horrified, but Harmonia stroked the glistening neck of the crested serpent, and suddenly not one but two snakes were there, their coils intertwined, until they sought the shelter of the neighboring woods. And even now, as serpents, they neither avoid people nor try to harm them, quietly remembering what they once were. That's Ovid, folks. Thank you.